I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Maggie Dawn Show here on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm really excited because for the first time, I get to host Professor Franklin from Marquette University's Law School, the pollster with the mostest. I was trying to think of a better rhyme, but that's what I got this afternoon, Professor. And Marquette just put out poll results from late March, the day after our primary elections. So much to talk about, Professor. Welcome and thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. First of all, I just thank you for the polling work that you do. I think it is incredibly informative and has helped people understand not just what's happening nationally, but the particularities and the little ebbs and flows that we have here in Wisconsin. It's some really great work. Tell us the big top line takeaway from your most recent poll.
Well, the most recent one, the one that went out last week, is a national poll, not a Wisconsin poll. But the story is pretty much the same, a very tight race in the presidential race. Nationally, we have that race at 50-50 among registered voters. Biden leads 42-48 among likely voters. I caution that likely voters is a movable object. And so between now and November, who's actually likely to vote may change quite a bit. And we've seen that race tighten ever so slightly from a 2-point Trump lead in November to a 1-point lead in January to now a tie among registered voters. In the Wisconsin data in late January, we had it as a 49-49 tie. Other polling has been equally close. Fox News had it at 47-47 a little more recently. We'll have a new look at Wisconsin next Wednesday. We'll be releasing a new poll for us. So we'll get an update on how the race here looks.
And where can folks go to find your poll results?
Law.marquette.edu/poll, P-O-L-L. That's the main landing page. And on that page, you'll see the latest press release that we've done for the latest results. And at the top on a tab, you'll see results and data. And this is for the really ambitious folks that want to get all of the nerdery and all the details with every question we've asked, cross tabs about everything, the methodology statement, if you want to read that.
One of the things that I, as a complete data nerd and as an economist, that I enjoy is looking at the methodology. Before we get into that, I wanted to point out one interesting thing that I saw on the first summary table of this most recent national poll, and that was registered but not certain to vote. And that broke down 56% for Donald Trump, 44% for Joe Biden. I find to be just fascinating. And of course, your caveat is well taken, that who becomes likely to vote or not certain to vote is a malleable thing that will change indeed over time. Any takeaways that you see from that? I just thought, boy, that's interesting. Does it speak to perhaps some of the more traditional conservatives' dissatisfaction with a second Trump candidacy or a third Trump candidacy?
Well, I think it's a very interesting thing that historically we thought high turnout favors Democrats. Democrats want to get a lot more people registered. That'll be good for them. But in this March national poll, but also in the January and in last November's polls, we see Biden doing best with people who are registered and say they're absolutely certain they're going to vote. That's the Biden by four that we just mentioned a minute ago. But when you go to people who are registered, but say, oh, maybe I wouldn't vote. I'll probably vote. Maybe not. Trump leads that 56-44, a big lead with those less than certain voters. And if you push it one more step to people 18 and over, but who are not registered to vote, Trump's lead is 64-36. And so you can really see how the world has turned upside down between thinking that core voters are more likely to be Republican, peripheral voters who need to be mobilized are more Democrat. At least in these three polls, it's just the opposite of that. Trump has succeeded in part by mobilizing people who in the past were not regular voters. We saw that in 2016. We saw it especially strongly in 2020. And so far, the polling seems to hold that up this time, too.
It's such an interesting time for data wonks and people that enjoy splicing these numbers in this way. One of the things that I hoped you could shed a little light on, so we often hear in different polls about the margin of error. Where does that come from? What is it? How should people understand that? And just for full information's sake, the margin of error with the Marquette University most recent national poll that just came in was 4.3 percentage points. Explain to people what that is and why is there a margin of error? Yeah.
The margin of error is a statistical property of a sample. When we take a random sample of a population, we're not interviewing everybody, right? And so there's, if we did the sample a second time, we'd get a somewhat different answer. If we did it a third time, we'd get a somewhat different answer. So the margin of error is a calculation that says, how much variation would we expect from doing these samples over and over again? How much would they vary? And they'd vary by that calculation in our data by about 4% or a little more than 4%. That mostly depends on the sample size. But in our reporting, we also account for additional margin of error because we don't have a perfect sample. We weight the data so that we have the right percentage of young people and old people, white, black, and Hispanic people, high education, low education, and so on. That weighting, which every pollster does, adds some to the margin of error beyond just the sample size. We have always reported with that extra uncertainty. Some pollsters don't and still report only based on the sample size. That's more of a statistics lesson than anybody wanted. Sorry.
I don't know that it is. And the reason that I ask is I think these things are really important. Polls tend to get a lot of press. They're interesting, admittedly.
Yeah.
But I also think, you know, campaigns tend to use polls to demonstrate momentum. And so for us to understand as voters and those that are receiving as a swing state, so much campaign advertising, I think it's really important for people to understand the way that those who conduct the poll weight different groups of people ends up impacting the margin of error. And if I can put it in very lay person terms, Professor Franklin, Marquette's poll generally has reported higher margins of error. The reason for that is not that the poll isn't as good as other polls, but that the assumptions are more humble, more conservative. You're expressing a greater level of potential uncertainty. Am I getting that mostly right?
No, you're exactly right. Taking account of that extra uncertainty due to weighting is standard statistical procedure if you're taking a graduate course in survey design. It had not been something that most pollsters reported until the last 10 or 15 years, partly because the weighting wasn't so much of a deal and mostly because we were stuck in our ways and didn't bother to change. At the Marquette poll, we started adding that on very early and have included it always. I want to say two quick things about this. One is, in a very close race like we've seen in recent Wisconsin elections and likely in the national elections, it's pretty likely that the margin in the polls is actually going to be inside the margin of error for all polls. You know, maybe we'll get up to a 5 or 6 point lead here in Wisconsin, but we don't see those very often, something that would be outside the margin of error. And so a good question is, well, okay, if everything close is inside the margin of error, what should I take away from that? And that's a good question. One thing is, instead of looking at the margin of error, look at track record over time. That's kind of hard for most people to get. But for the Marquette poll, our average error on the margin in races, in all the statewide races we've done since 2012, our average error is 2.2 percentage points. And so if you see our results within 2.2 points, you should say, well, that's really close. And their margin of their actual error, not margin of error, which is more like four, but their actual average error could easily be off by 2 points. But it's less likely that it's off by three, much less likely that it's off by four. Though 2016, we were off by nearly seven in the presidential race. So don't think it can never happen. We have had one really bad outcome in our races. But I think that 2.2 average error is maybe a more useful standard to look at rather than the theoretical margin of error of the polling, with that caveat that this could always be a bad year.
I really appreciate that humbly and accurately stated, Professor Franklin. I'm going to ask you a little bit when we come back about what you changed coming out of that bumpy year for all of us prognosticators and commentators included there, and also about why it's important to pay attention to how questions are asked in polls when we come back, so that we all can be smarter citizens, smarter voters, and better consumers of information. Joined this half hour by Professor Charles Franklin of Marquette University Law School. Don't go anywhere. We're going to take a couple messages and we're all going to get smarter with the professor when we come back.
Into the sky. Do you think time went past me by? 'Cause you know I'd walk 1,000 miles.
I'd walk 1,000 miles to read one of his polls because they're so excellent. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network, and my guest this half hour is Professor Charles Franklin from Marquette University. We were talking before the break about how to help folks understand and become savvier consumers of polls. And I think some of your insights are so critical for folks. Pay attention to the margin of error, yes, but look at their historical track record. How well has the poll performed versus actual outcomes? Marquette polls among, if not the best in the country, with basically a 2.2% margin of error. But you mentioned that you had one rough election cycle, as I think many of us did. And I wanted to ask you, what did you do after the 2016 cycle to improve the polling?
Yeah, we've done a number of things, though not all of them immediately after 2016. We obviously looked at the error and tried to figure out where we'd been wrong. We were in a lot of good company, but that's small solace for being wrong. We've made several small changes and one recent big change. In 2016, we asked people, are you going to vote for Clinton or Trump? And we didn't really push the undecideds for who they would vote for. And so that left 12 or 14% still saying undecided late in the election. we've shifted since then to always ask the question, including or haven't you decided? But then if you haven't decided, we say, well, if you had to choose today, who would you vote for? That came out of 2016 because exit polls showed that a lot of late deciders broke very heavily for Trump. We'll never know because we didn't ask the question, but it looks like if we had asked, well, if you had to decide, who would you vote for? We might have been a bit closer. I'm not sure it would have solved the problem, but we would have gotten a bit closer. Another thing is that what we saw in 16 and to a lesser degree, but still saw in 2020, was getting the Democratic vote pretty close, but understating the Republican vote. And we think that a lot of that is because Donald Trump does mobilize a set of voters who don't usually participate in elections or don't do it at the same rate as others. But he gets them to the polls. But those folks are also really skeptical of answering polls. And so we have a real problem reaching Trump voters who also agree to be interviewed. And it's not big. I don't want to overstate it. But if it's a 3 or 4% of the public that likes Donald Trump and doesn't want to talk to pollsters, that's lowering our estimated Trump vote. What we've done, and especially since 2022, we've changed some things. We're now sampling in a way that gives us a lot more precision on reaching all areas of the state, including both the Trumpiest parts and the most Democratic parts. Just to give you a sense, we used to sample across 5 geographic regions of the state, you know, Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, and so on. We now sample in 90 distinct regions of the state that are stratified from the most Republican, most Trump area to the most Democratic area. And that's a design change that means we're zeroing in on all of those levels of geographic concentration of both Trump voters and Democratic voters. We'll find out in November if that's going to really work well. We think it will. And our current results and our results last year looked good. But the proof is in the pudding and we won't really know until November.
It is a fascinating time. I wanted to also ask you a bit about helping people to understand the impacts on polls of how the survey questions are constructed.
Sure.
I mentioned I was an economist, got my graduate degree in that, and spent some time doing a willingness to pay analysis, which if you get the question wrong, forget about it, throw it out. It's basically not worth even trying to analyze the data. Tell people, how important is the way that the questions are asked?
It certainly matters. In our poll, my polling, we try to write, I'll take responsibility for this, though I get help with my colleagues. I try to write the least exciting question I can ask. I minimize the adjectives that I use because I don't want to tilt the question by the adjective. So I try to go straightforward in the question. If there's a reasonable two sides to the issue, I try to present options for both sides, not just one side. And those are sort of maybe obvious things, but they're important things to do. The question wording, I've actually got a good example of this. Sometimes we deliberately alter the question. So in this most recent national poll, we asked a question about the Supreme Court ruling that Trump should not be taken off the ballot by Colorado. And in a random experiment, random split sample experiment, half the people, the question mentioned this court had ruled unanimously. In the other half, we left out the word unanimous. Made almost no difference, maybe a 2-point difference.
Interesting.
But on another question, we asked whether the Supreme Court should say that presidents, former presidents, are immune from criminal prosecution, or former President Trump is immune from criminal prosecution. So that's a little more of a pungent question wording difference, right? Mm-hmm. And it turns out that people saying Trump should be immune from prosecution is about 8 points higher than just former presidents. But dig down a little deeper, and it's all because Republicans completely flipped on the question. Without Trump being named, only 36% of Republicans said former presidents should be immune. With Trump mentioned, it was 55%. Democrats and independents got slightly more against immunity when Trump was mentioned, but only by 2 or 3 points. And so it's not just partisan polarization. Otherwise, Democrats would have gotten a lot more negative about it and independents right. somewhat more. It really suggests that maybe Republicans, unprompted by Trump's name, actually are not attentive or not getting enough news about Trump's legal issues. But when mentioned, oh, yes, that's my guy. I'm on his side. Yes. But it says something about media consumption and how people, especially Republicans, are getting news or following news about Trump's legal issues that may be more interesting than anything else. Anyway, those are two examples where question wording, in one case, I thought it might make a difference and it made very little. In the other, it made a significant difference, but especially with an interesting group of people, Republicans.
Thank you so much. That's Professor Charles Franklin of Marquette University Law School telling us all how to be better consumers of polls and pointing out to some fascinating results that came out just last week. You can find those results at law.marquette.edu/poll. I'm Maggie Dawn. Stick with us. We'll be back with more breaking news after these quick messages.
Pointing me in a crooked line, and the less I seek my source for some definitive, closer I am.
Welcome, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. I am really excited this afternoon to be joined by Graham Kilmer, a reporter for Urban Milwaukee. And I just want to say this writ large. Thank goodness for Urban Milwaukee and local reporting. It has taken such a hit in the last 20 years. And local reporters like yourself, Graham, are those that keep local government honest and keep elected officials honest. We're going to talk a little bit about that today. Just last night, Graham, you released an article on Urban Milwaukee's website relating to some pretty extraordinary raises for three elected officials at Milwaukee County. I've talked about this before on the show for those that haven't heard it. About, I don't know, a month and a half ago, the county executive proposed just about 11% raise for the Milwaukee County treasurer, register of deeds, and county clerk. At the next board meeting, that was changed to a 36% raise, which is unprecedented, historic, and it comes within a context that your colleague Bruce Murphy at Urban Milwaukee pointed out, which is most insiders within county government know that these elected offices are in many ways functionary offices. Yes, the leadership has some impact on the operation of the offices, but these are elected officials. They know what the salaries are, and they have staffs many times of subject matter experts that work for them. They're accountable to no one other than voters. And since most voters have no idea what any of these people actually do, it's a low level of accountability. And so historically, and when compared to other counties, these offices don't tend to earn as much as many other and some other leaders within county government. The 36% raise caught some folks by surprise. It only garnered one objection on the county at the county board, but the county executive vetoed that raise. Tomorrow, on a Friday at 4 p.m., the county board is going to reconvene to consider whether or not to override County Executive David Crowley's veto of a historic, unprecedented 36% raise for three officers that basically nobody knows what they do at the county if you're a regular person. And your article yesterday, Graham, brought some new information to light. First of all, welcome. I'm really appreciative to have you. Tell folks a little bit about what the new reporting that came out yesterday is sharing with folks.
Hi, Maggie. Well, thanks for having me. So I think the new thing that came to light yesterday is that essentially these elected officials were lobbying for these raises. And that becomes an issue, I think, because the raises themselves are, as you said, pretty extraordinary. 36% is what they'll hit after 4 years from a salary that is already pushing six figures. Regardless of what they do, I think what's really at issue here is that these elected officers were holding private conversations with the politicians, the elected officials who will control their compensation. So this is effectively a political process that they're seeking to influence. I can't think of a clear-cut example of what the definition of, I guess you would say, lobbying would be. I mean, under almost any other circumstances, if you're communicating with a politician or providing information, which is something that these officials have told me is simply all they were doing, providing information, you would be, under any other context, lobbying. But for some reason, in the Milwaukee County Courthouse, it's not lobbying. You're simply just having a chat. Now, I should be careful. I don't know that these conversations all took place in the courthouse. I'm being a little facetious there. I'm trying to speak more to what I would call an institutional culture, which is essentially that, based on my reporting and speaking with a lot of people that were involved in this, no one thought that anything that was occurring wasn't above board. And I think that that's kind of an important detail, which is that, I mean, I guess you can't see what's in people's hearts, but when everyone's saying that, oh, this is normal, well, that itself was kind of a striking piece of information.
Let me just jump in here. I want to just to summarize a couple of points Graham made here. One is that based upon Graham's interviews and reporting, nobody at the county seemed to think this was a big deal, perhaps other than the county executive and human resources. That's thing one. Thing two is these are unprecedented, historic raises. And what your reporting is bringing out is that these three individuals went to county board supervisors who control their composition and human resources and effectively said, give me this raise. I deserve this raise. We should get this raise. And then made an argument that to not give them a raise would violate county ordinance. In other words, you have to give me this raise because not doing so would violate the law. Am I getting that right? So the three things are, nobody thought much of it, which itself is pretty surprising. Thing two, the raises are historic. The county executive seemed to have a problem with it. And they were going around and asking for these raises and have claimed that to not give them a 36% raise would somehow violate the law. And they were lobbying on their own behalf, meaning I would like you to give me more money. And none of these three people, nor the supervisors they were talking to, seemed to find any of those things amiss. Am I getting the three main highlights here correct?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things you mentioned, I think, is worth kind of digging into even a little deeper, and that's specifically what they were telling supervisors. Now, if you tell someone you need to pay me more money or else you're breaking the law, I don't know how that doesn't meet the definition of lobbying. Or, but I mean, talk about a coercive statement. You go to a lawmaker, a policymaker, a county board member, and you say, the level of compensation the county is providing me is breaking the county's own laws. Okay, that's a pretty bold claim. And it's a bold claim that the county's attorneys, frankly, completely disagree with.
Yeah, to read from your article very briefly, and I want to give the law that these three people keep referring to is County Ordinance 17.98. It says this, the positions of clerk, county clerk, register of deeds, and county treasurer are constitutional officers. They serve as the department head and manager of their respective functional area and should be compensated accordingly. They're paid $91,000 a year. They are the only elected official department heads, if you will, other than the county executive. I believe most other department head cabinet level officials, their salaries start at $117,000. The original proposed raise would have brought their compensation to $102,000 a year. The 36% raise blows right past $117,000 a year and gets them to $123,000 a year. And the county's lawyer, acting corporation Scott Brown, said that the ordinance is extremely subjective and that you can't say that this is a mandated raise. That's a correct set of facts. Did I get that right, Graham?
Yeah. And actually, there's a few things here that are worth pointing out. And one of them is how we arrive at this 36% raise. The County Executive's Administration, HR department, they put forward this 11.5% raise. Now, Supervisor Liz Sumner told me that before HR puts this raise forward, these three officers had approached her and discussed potentially a resolution from the supervisors. Now, it's my understanding that, legally speaking, that's not that odd because this is a political process. It's, you know, it's kind of cagey, dicey, shady, not really above board. Sure, I've heard people say those things, but it could have been done that way. The board could have acted without any prior action from the county executive. But I'm getting away here. So HR, they put forward this raise. Now, what we know is that these officers didn't like the 11.5% raise. And they went to HR and they wanted a bigger raise. And the justification for this bigger raise is this legal interpretation. And what they would have us believe is that a supervisor on the county board somehow magically had a parallel thought and interpreted the ordinance this exact same way and came to the conclusion that, yes, the 11.5% raise isn't enough. Let's give them more. And then you end up with this amendment entered by Supervisor Tony Staskunas that brings an already incredible raise up to this 36% after 4 years, $124,000. And I think it's worth pointing out that this kind of gets to another aspect of the, what you might call the institutional culture of county government, which is a view that has prevailed for a really long time. And it kind of, I think maybe a lot of people thought that it had kind of gone away. But it's this notion that county government is a piggy bank that can be tapped by elected officials. It's the exact same sort of thinking that led 20 years ago to that terrible pension backdrop plan that the county is still paying for. I mean, these officers feel entitled to make $124,000. They have told me as much.
Yeah. I want to point out a couple of things and make a couple of distinctions. First of all, this isn't going to cost the county nearly as much as the pension scandal did. But what you're pointing to is an attitude of entitlement to additional compensation. That's what I object to. I object to the process. I believe this was not above board. I believe these are ethics violations because the Milwaukee County Ethics Code explicitly prohibits using your public position for personal gain. Meeting privately with HR and supervisors saying 11.5% of a raise isn't enough. I want 36% because I deserve it. And forwarding a completely bogus legal interpretation is exactly using the fact that you're a current occupant of an elected office to benefit yourself personally by getting yourself a raise. And I just want to point these couple of things out. The Register of Deeds said in your article that there was hesitancy of HR in meeting with you. He further said that while he's an attorney and he admitted that the Register of Deeds isn't the county's attorney and isn't there to dispense legal advice, yet he did so admittedly anyways, that he admits that in your article. And finally, he then says, again, I don't think any lawyer would say there's a violation with us pointing out and giving supervisors or HR notice that the ordinance on officer pay is not being abided by. That's not proper influence. That's giving notice to a party that they're not compliant with the law. I'm just going to say I'm any attorney. I disagree. The ordinance doesn't require that, and you've committed an ethics violation. Graham, we have run out of time. I would like to have you back. We're going to watch the meeting tomorrow to see what happens. Folks, you can find Graham Kilmer's reporting of Urban Milwaukee at urbanmilwaukee.com. Thanks for the excellent work here, keeping local elected officials honest. Graham, hats off to you for your scoop here. I'm Maggie Dawn. Come back with us in just a moment. We've got even more breaking news and yet another breaking news guest after these quick messages. Thanks much, Graham. Welcome, Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. My thanks to Graham Kilmer of Urban Milwaukee for exposing the inside dealings between Register of Deeds, County Clerk, and County Treasurer trying to agitate for a nearly 40% raise behind closed doors. And in this lawyer's legal opinion, in violation of the ethics rules of Milwaukee County and forwarding an absolutely bogus interpretation of an at best vague beyond any recognition county ordinance. I can't believe they scheduled the veto override meeting for tomorrow at 4 p.m. It's Friday at 4. No one's going to be paying any attention. Here's the other reason why they did it. Because new supervisors get sworn in on Monday, April 15th. So the three guys wouldn't have their buddies that they've worked with forever deciding about their raise.
Yeah.
But I've got a special guest joining me because there has been more breaking news that came out late last night, this morning. And someone that I know would never put up with such inside baseball shenanigans in government. This is candidate for Wisconsin's 8th Congressional District, Dr. Kristen Lierley, who joined me just yesterday. Thanks for coming back right away. I asked you today, reached out right away, because Dan Bice of the Journal Sentinel ran at what we lay folks would call a hit piece, indicating that you were once, quote, reprimanded for waiting too long to deliver a baby in Minnesota. I reached out to you because I thought when I read the detail in the article, while the headline is accurate, it paints a really distorting picture of what happened. And Dr. Lierley, I wanted to give you an opportunity to address that article. What do you say in response to this? What was going on there? Help folks understand.
This is really, like you said, it's a hit piece. This is just a rehash of what we saw in 2020. So this is an old case, and I can't really speak about the case because, of course, you know, HIPAA patient privacy, but I can tell you that obstetrics is a tricky business, and we don't always hit it perfectly. But in this case, I delivered a healthy baby and everything was fine. And, you know, you can read the article if you want the details. And the report itself is publicly available. All you have to do is Google my name and Google the information, and it's out there. But I think this is not the point. The point is that when I first ran, the Republican Party back in 2020 posted this. They sent flyers out to all of my constituents, not talking about the actual what happened here with the case, but that I was a terrible doctor. Well, anybody who knows me, for the past 15 years, I've been practicing medicine. My colleagues, the nurses that I work with and staff, my patients know that I'm all about taking care of my patients. So this is garbage. We expected this to happen. You know, we saw last week on regular Joe's radio show up here in Green Bay, he had Andre Jacques on and they talked all about how I was a terrible doctor. And then earlier this week, we saw Scott Walker picking on me. We've clearly hit a nerve here, Maggie, and frankly, I'm enjoying it. Bring it on, guys, because clearly they feel threatened, and this is all they got.
Yeah, I wanted to just pull this out from the article where you explain that one, monitoring fetal heartbeats is complex, mm-hmm. and that there is judgment involved about whether and when to proceed with a cesarean section if a fetal heartbeat is slowing down. And of course, you cannot speak about the particular case, but that it's very difficult and you were making on the fly decisions. There's an implication in the article that you voluntarily suspended your privileges in response to this complaint. I want to be sure that this accusation or this salacious hit piece you have been able to fully respond to it. Just share with people a little bit of the context of those two particular items.
Yeah, so I suspended my privileges, not at all related to this case. It was for personal reasons. We were living in Minnesota at the time, and one of my sons wasn't happy. So we were moving back to Wisconsin. So that's a coincidence. But, you know, with regards to delivering a baby, anybody who's had a baby who's been hooked up to those monitors knows that it's tough to interpret these strips. And some of them are really easy. Some of them are very straightforward, but most of them are actually pretty complicated. Nurses know, we take classes, doctors take classes. We even have studies that show that high-risk doctors interpret these strips, and then when they come back to look at them a second time, they interpret them differently. Mm-hmm. So they're very, very subjective. And one thing we know about how this affects outcomes is that it just makes us do more C-sections. So we have to be really thoughtful as we are approaching any obstetrical event. And, you know, we're always ready for, we're hoping for the best, we're prepared for the worst. Usually things go really well. And in this case, fortunately, they did. But we're always learning. We're always getting better. And, this piece didn't reflect the actual medical reality behind the stipulation.
Yeah, the media, and I will, I'm sure, either have been or will be guilty of sort of pumping up an issue to get people engaged and to drive listenership or eyeballs. But this is sort of the bread and butter of this particular author from time to time. And I found that really concerning because using something that was a judgment call that has so much variability to it, many women do not want a C-section. They want to proceed and complete with a vaginal birth. There's so much going into those judgments. Again, your personal family circumstances that came into play here, just absolutely irresponsible. Here's who I'm never going to take obstetric or gynecological advice from, and that would be Andre Jacques. give me a freaking break. And no wonder they're talking about it. And no wonder Scott Walker's getting into the mix. I mean, go back to the playpen, Scott. Your opinions aren't wanted here. It's because clearly the extremists and the way that the Republican Party has been co-opted by MAGA, they're now absolutely petrified of a passionate, dedicated woman who has served women and families in rural communities in the 8th District, in Minnesota, in Arizona, like yourself, who can actually speak to scientific realities, to speak with medical accuracy, and have an informed debate about these critical things. Last words, Kristen, what would you like to say to voters in the 8th District?
Maggie, it's just like this race. It's a hard job, but I'm up for it. This is the time for us to stand together and to get some hard work done. So just let's do it.
I love it. From Dr. Kristen Lierley, candidate for the 8th Congressional District, bring it on. I'm Maggie Dawn. That's it for this Thursday afternoon's episode. I'll be back tomorrow. I'll stand up for you. I hope you stand up for me. But always remember, it is better when we stand together.